Welcome to A Public Affair here on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host today, Shannon Young. People across the country are still digesting the ruling handed down by a Supreme Court majority Friday that effectively overruled a pillar of reproductive rights that had been in place for nearly 50 years. While it wasn't necessarily a surprise, it still sent out shockwaves. Here to parse through the meaning and the implications of the court's ruling are Imani Gandhi and Jessica Peeklow. Imani Gandhi is senior editor of law and policy for Rewire News Group and is the founder of the Angry Black Lady Chronicles. Jessica Mason Peeklow is senior vice president and executive editor at Rewire News Group. She co-wrote the books The End of Roe v. Wade and Crow After Roe. Both Peeklow and Gandhi are former practicing attorneys and together co-host Rewire News Group's Boom Lawyered podcast. They also both live here in Boulder, Colorado. Thanks to you both for making room to join me on the program. I know that you both have a packed schedule of media appearances today.
Oh, thanks for having us. It's, you know, our pleasure, and especially, you know, processing the meaning and the impact of the decision, particularly for a state like Colorado that is now just such a critical access point for reproductive health care in particular. It was our pleasure to make the time.
Great. Give us a sense, please, of how major is this ruling overall for civil rights in the U.S.?
It's major. The Supreme Court has never taken a fundamental right away that has been formerly given. They have, and they've been trying to roll back access to abortion rights. They've regulated rights, they've rolled them back, but they've never said, hey, have this right. And then 50 years later said, just kidding, you can no longer have this right. And what's so distressing about the tenor of the opinion is that the fact that so many women and people who are capable of becoming pregnant have relied on this decision for 50 years, it has informed the way they plan their families. It has informed what schools they go to, when they decide to get a degree, what career path they choose. I mean, it is integral to a person's economic circumstances that they be permitted bodily autonomy, that they be permitted to have children or not have children when they see fit. So to tell people that they can no longer have this constitutional right and then discard the reliance and the sort of chaos that such a decision will cause was just cruel, in my viewpoint. I think Alito's opinion was cruel.
Absolutely. And just to build on what Imani has said, I appreciate the framing of your question as the impact that the Dobbs decision will have on civil rights, because this is truly the unraveling of a thread of privacy rights that will not stop with the right to abortion. We will see the court come after other sexual privacy rights as well that depend on Roe and also existed before Roe as well. So that includes the right to use contraception, for example, and the right to be in relationship with a person that you love, regardless of their sex or gender.
Or race.
Or race. Really, truly, it's really all on the line.
Right. Get a bit more into that when it comes to people's ability to decide who they will have as a partner, be it in a same-sex union, be it in an interracial marriage. What exactly does abortion have to do with any of that?
Sure. So the right to an abortion is based on the right to privacy. And this is a broad constitutional concept that the court has accepted and has worked with and has worked within for well over 50 years before, you know, in addition to Roe. And so what the court does when it builds law in precedent is it stacks it on each other. So if we think of it as a Jenga tower, for example, around privacy rights, one of the things that the court did by overturning Roe versus Casey is take one of those crucial blocks from the Jenga tower away. And so now everything is on the precipice of collapsing. And Justice Clarence Thomas told us that himself in his concurring opinion. Without the right to privacy, which can be found in a variety of other rights in the Constitution. The First Amendment, the Ninth Amendment, and the 14th Amendment are actual locuses of that right to privacy. From there, the Supreme Court has held in previous cases that individuals have the right to conduct their lives as they see fit with minimal interference from the government. What does that look like? Enter into relationships around how to build family with minimal interference from the government, right? We regulate that in some ways. We require people to have marriage licenses, for example. Those are some ways that we can regulate, that we've regulated those institutions. And by removing a key cornerstone of privacy protections, now all of those privacy protections are called into question under this court.
And it's not just necessarily in same-sex marriage or interracial marriage, but also even just in, you could say, a traditional marriage of a man and a woman. There was also a reference to the access to contraception.
Yeah, I mean, contraception is, you know, one thing I really like to remind people is that contraception was made legal for couples in 1965. It wasn't legal for single people until 1972. So that's 2 years before Roe. That's 2 years before I was born. A lot of your listeners were already born then. So when we talk about them coming for other rights, it's really these rights called substantive due process rights. The rights that Jess has been talking about are substantive due process rights. And I like to describe them as rights that relate to how people make relationships with one another. So marriage, same-sex marriage, sexual relationships, you know, Lawrence v. Texas, which is the case that decriminalized quote unquote sodomy, is also on the line. Marriage, the right to parent, Jessica always points out that that's on the line. If you want to homeschool your children, that right might be on the line. So, you know, What Jess said is, I mean, I love the Jenga analogy. Sonia Sotomayor actually made that analogy in her dissent. You know, she said, you know, if you take out Roe v. Wade, it's like taking out a block from the middle and saying the tower's not going to collapse. The tower is collapsing. And my concern now, and I think I could speak for Jess, is that people are not prepared for what is coming. And I don't think it's because they're unintelligent, and I don't think it's because they're ill-informed. I think a lot of it is because of trauma. Like, it is a traumatic event to have an institution of this, to have one of the branches of government in this country tell you as a woman that you are no longer a full and equal citizen, right? And if you happen to be a queer woman, then to think about what that means once your rights as a queer person are also down the toilet, that's a lot of trauma. That's a lot of information that is hard to deal with. And I think a lot of people's way of dealing with it is to just push it to the side and say, I'm going to deal with it later. I can't cope now. But we are in such an accelerationist period that people don't have time. Honestly, they don't. If you're queer, you don't have time to take a breath and just deal with it. You need to start getting your affairs in order. You need to start having contractual backups, wills, trusts, you know, powers of attorney, those sorts of things. I think we are living through a collective traumatic moment. And I think that we need to give each other the space to live in that moment, but we also need to encourage each other not to wallow and to keep moving, to keep pushing and fighting, because that's what it's going to take, because they are moving very quickly to destroy our rights.
And I think people are also not fully prepared for the moment, because there are a lot of liberals and progressives who believe in good faith that the institutions are not out there to harm us. And what conservatives have shown us is the opposite, is that they intend to use these institutions and weaponize them against us. And that is a disorienting place if you are a liberal or a progressive that believes in using institutions for social change, for social good.
I think that the point that you touch on is one of the most culture shock type of moments of just moving here to Boulder. I'm like, Imani, like you and I are both fairly recent arrivals to Boulder. And I was born and raised in Texas. And so I think I'm taking this in a way of like my contingency planning brain knows exactly where this is going. And it's not a good place. And I think that you're right, Jessica, that there is a lot of faith in institutions in places that are comfortably blue, where, you know, people could comfortably think, you know, well, we're going to be okay here. That's too bad for Texas and all of those other red states, but we're going to be fine. And so I'm just, again, going to push this to the side, think about it later, because it doesn't directly affect me. Should Coloradans feel safe that abortion is protected here?
abortion's protected in Colorado by statute, and that is a good thing for right now. So we have some amazing leaders in the reproductive rights and justice movement here in Colorado, particularly women of color who saw the writing on the wall and pushed our elected officials to pass and enact the Reproductive Health Equity Act this year. And RHEA is an important, critical foundation for abortion rights and access protection in Colorado. But because it's a statute, that means it's vulnerable to repeal. So that is, it's like we're protected, but we don't have the super status of protection that a constitutional amendment here in Colorado would give us. And this is really important because you mentioned Texas. You know, before the Supreme Court even dropped the Dobbs decision, it allowed Texas's SB 8, that 6-week abortion ban with the bounty hunter provision, to take effect. And what we saw in Colorado here was almost an immediate increase of over 500% of pressure on providers to provide care from people traveling from out of state. That's only increased since Oklahoma has since banned abortion. And now that Dobbs has dropped and more of our neighboring states will enact their own bans, the pressure on Colorado and New Mexico providers is going to be intense. And that means that if you need an abortion and you are a Coloradan, you may not physically be able to get an appointment given the need on our system and our providers right now. Don't assume that if you need an abortion today in Colorado, you can get one. Access to the procedure is still a huge hurdle.
There's so many points to pick apart here, but let's go to the bounty hunter provision. Is there any kind of legal precedent, and how is this likely to play out now that that Roe is officially overruled?
I'm not aware of any legal precedent that permits a state to outsource its law enforcement to the general public, which is essentially what Texas did. I was always of the mind last fall, I was confused as to why Texas did it, because they knew that Roe was going to be dead in 10 months. So that just shows the Republicans in Texas are when it comes to stripping people of their rights. So I was confused at the time, but you know, looking back now, this whole year, it gave people a time to just get used to it, right? Like you said, oh, it's going to happen in Texas, so it doesn't really affect me here. And so I think there was a level of sort of complacency that set in. And I think that that was intentional. And I also think that the leak was sort of intentional to bring about this level of complacency. Fortunately, it doesn't seem to have worked, and I'm very happy about that. But if I could for a moment go back to what you were saying about faith in institutions, this is where I start to get really irritated with Democrats, right? With Democrats in office, not Democratic people, because they have such faith in institutions that the response from most Democrats has been, well, we can just vote in November, right? You know, Republicans have taken away your right to choose. Well, you have a right to choose in November. I saw a comic, I think it was Mike L, I can't pronounce his last name. He's a great Pulitzer winning cartoonist. But I saw that comic and I was like, no, because you're having faith in the institution of voting. And we already know that people don't have the right to vote anymore. They have systematically voter suppressed and gerrymandered states that they know that they need to grab in order to maintain control. So people don't have the right to vote. So insisting that the right to vote is going to fix this when we have a Democratic Party that has not nuked the filibuster in order to pass voting rights legislation, it's all of these things are compounding on top of each other, right? One of the things that we're concerned about when it comes to these bounty hunter provisions is that it is turning neighbors on neighbors, right? It is making neighbors agents of the state. So neighbors are going out and ferreting out felonies that people are committing. And then what happens? You've committed a felony, you're prosecuted for it, you're convicted for it, and now you're a convicted felon and you can't vote. Right. So we're entering a period where where so many pro-choice advocates and activists are going to likely be breaking laws in some respect, or certainly law enforcement will try to say that they are, will try to convict them of crimes and then take them out of the voting pool. So all the people who are pro-choice and you know, stand reproductive justice, if I may use a colloquialism, are not going to be able to vote in representatives who will have their back in that way. And that's what's really so frustrating when I hear people say, vote harder. How are these people supposed to vote harder?
And I just want to go back to the bounty hunter provision too, because there's a real moment for us to connect what is happening in our present to our past. We have, in the abortion rights context, not seen these kinds of provisions before. But in this country, we do have a history of deputizing citizens to do the state's dirty work in the form of the Fugitive Slave Act and possibly the Tatus laws. And the idea there is that this is all inherently anti-democratic that requires agents of the state to enforce. So this idea that Imani talks about of neighbors snitching on neighbors is absolutely true in a post-Roe reality. We are in a place where surveillance of our neighbors is rewarded financially by anti-abortion activists. That's unheard of, and it's dangerous. We have bounties on people who are trying to provide healthcare to folks. That's wild.
And this wasn't the only controversial ruling made last week. I mean, there was a compound effect of several rulings that were made. One of them had to do with the access to a concealed carry permit, which could possibly have implications when it comes to states regulating firearms and the way that those firearms are carried and displayed. We have an issue with federal agents basically being able to overstep their bounds, even if they're off the clock and out of uniform. And recently, there was also a case of if you're with border control and enforcement and immigration, you can go into homes within a 100-mile range of the border, and that can be a sea border, that can be a land border, go into homes without search warrants. So just taken together, where exactly are we going and what should we prepare for?
We are moving towards a system where the only rights that matter are the rights of white, cisgendered, and probably ultimately property-owning men. We are moving to a world where people's civil rights are being systematically stripped. And what's worse, I mean, that's bad enough, but what's worse about it is that it's being inflicted on us by six people who were chosen by a dark money group that is funded by untold people to the tune of millions and millions of dollars. These six people effectively control the rights of marginalized people in this country. And that is distressing. That's really distressing. And to bring it back to your point about the other decisions that came out, one of the brilliant things about Sonia Sotomayor's dissent is that she has a whole page where she talks about the hypocrisy of literally the day before the court saying that the state is not authorized to regulate guns in the manner that it sees fit. And then the very next day saying that the government can't regulate abortion, that states have to do it, right? I mean, it's incongruous, but the point is that, and that's, I think, a sticking point where people get tripped up because, again, with faith in institutions, we expect the Supreme Court to act principally, right? It's an august institution that has gravitas. We expect them to behave in a manner that they're supposed to behave, and they're not. They are finding where they want to go, and they are making up law to get there. And if the law is completely, you know, anathema to something they said the day before, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
They just did that this morning in a school prayer case. I mean, we had, like you mentioned, a bunch of really terrible decisions that the court issued. And we have not even talked about the fact that they are undergoing a project of entirely rewriting the First Amendment. And today did so by upholding a decision that would allow and you know, in some instances, based on sort of soft social pressures, require prayer in public school. And they did so by entirely abandoning a, you know, long held principle of constitutional analysis called the Lemon Test. They didn't say they overruled it. In the decision in Kennedy versus Bremerton today, they just said they're abandoning it and allowing this, you know, and says that the establishment clause and the free expression clause requires school to allow a football coach to pray at the 50-yard line with his team at halftime. I was a student athlete in school. Would I feel like I had an equal space on these sports teams if I did not feel comfortable engaging in a particular prayer? Right? Because let's be clear, what the court is doing here in its religious cases. We are not seeing a robust expansion of the idea of religious liberties in public spaces for everyone. We are seeing a weaponization of the First Amendment to shield evangelical Christians from legal liability when it's convenient and to allow them to weaponize it when it's even more convenient as well.
So in our final 5 minutes, I want to look at the path forward. Right. So it's so easy with reactions to shock. You have fight, flight, or freeze. And I think that for a lot of people, they're also just mentally checking out. For those who are in a reaction mode, what are the viable paths forward?
One of the things that I always talk about, or I have been talking about always, it's been 3 days. One of the things that I've been talking about is physical and digital security. I mean, the first thing that I did was called all of my friends who I know have daughters or people in their houses that can get their periods and told them, tell your kids to get those period trackers off their apps. Sometimes with the period trackers, you have to email the app to tell them to delete your data. Even if you are a parent who is absolutely 100% sure that if your kid ever got pregnant and needed an abortion, they would come to you, there's a chance that they may not. So you need to arm your kids with information in advance. Information like, if you live in Texas, don't type the words, where can I get an abortion, into your computer without using a virtual private network, for example, something that can mask your IP address. Because, you know, what one of the hallmarks of this new era is mass digital surveillance. And that didn't exist in the 1960s, 1970s. So people were able to get around laws, A, because men were patriarchal and didn't believe women had any capacity to do anything, but B, because they were using landlines and payphones. Now we've got people trying to make plans on social media and doing really irresponsible things that could get them in trouble. So I would encourage people to be very careful.
Yeah. And I think, too, this is a really great opportunity to invest in your communities here. You know, Amani and I had the opportunity to do an in-person event last night at the Skylark Lounge with the Marigold Project. And being in a room with folks who were processing this, who wanted to, you know, jump in and help, everybody has a lane in this fight. And so just figuring out what your lane is really important. Maybe your lane is to donate money. Maybe your lane is to donate time and resources. Maybe your lane is just to talk to the people in your neighborhood and your community about what this impact of this decision means. I mean, we have a Democratic president who's reluctant to use the word abortion in his public remarks. It's really difficult to robustly defend a right you're afraid to say out loud. And so for those of us who have communication as a lane, that can be a really powerful one. And the final thing I would just say is that, you know, things will get darker. They will feel heavier, but this is part of an anti-democratic campaign generally that depends on people becoming hopeless and despondent. And we need to remain joyfully defiant in these moments. We will not go back. And it may take a while, but we're not going back.
This is a topic that we could go just dig into for days and days. And I'm sure that you will be covering it at Rewire News. Can you tell the audience a bit about Rewire and what kind of information they can find there?
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity. Sure. Rewire News Group is the nation's only independent nonprofit media organization dedicated exclusively to reproductive rights, health and justice news reporting and analysis. So Amani and I have been on this beat for a combined 10 plus years. You can find the work over at rewirenewsgroup.com and check out our podcast, Boom Lawyered, wherever you get podcasts. Amani and I are on the mic about once a week, breaking down what happens at the courts and with our rights and this expanding and, sort of all encompassing march towards, really dark days that we are working on. But we do try to leave everything with a note of action because that's important.
And that's going to do it for today's A Public Affair, a special public affair with Imani Gandhi and Jessica Piclo. Both of them are senior editors at Rewire News Group and co-hosts of the Boom Lawyered podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you
for having us.